Thank you.
And where are we holding?
Okay, we're in Masechet Sanhedrin. We're in Kazayin Amud Aleph 27a. And we were learning about an argument between Abai and Rava as to whether or not a person who was a Zomem witness, meaning that he was a false witness, found out whether, so they both agree that he's disqualified. The question that we looked at yesterday is when he was disqualified from. Was it retroactively, lamafreya, meaning from the time he testified and gave that bad testimony, or was it from the time that he was found out, the time that they made him, he was declared a zomem by the court, at that point he becomes disqualified? And that was a dispute that we looked at yesterday. Yeah. So now, after that, the Gemara gives a ruling. Amar Rav Yirmiyah Midifti. Rav Yirmiyah from Difti said, Avad Rav Papa Uvda Kavtei Derava. Rav Papi ruled according to Rava. In that dispute between Abai and Rava, what do we say? We said Abai holds Lamafreya and Rava holds Mikanbalahaba from now onwards. We went with, that was it. So Rav Papi says, go like Rava. Disqualify the person, not retroactively. Don't, because we're concerned about the purchasers, etc. Right? Or the Chiddush. Right? Don't do it, don't make them disqualified retroactively. Only from the time they're made Zomemim witnesses. Mar Bar Rav Ashi Amar says, Hilchata Kavte Da'abai, but he says no. Although we saw that Rav Papi ruled in a case like Rava, Rav Ashi says that actually the halacha is like Abai, which is that they're disqualified from the time they made the original testimony. And the Gemara concludes by saying, Ve'hilchata Kavtei Da'abai. The halacha is like Abai, like Rav Ashi says. In what cases? Ve'ya'al Kagam. Ya'al Kagam. What's Ya'al Kagam? So Ya'al Kagam is an acronym of six cases. Six different cases where we hold by Abai. In all other disputes in the Gemara, where you see a dispute between Abai and Rava, and there's a lot of them, we always hold by Rava. Except in six, these six which we'll look at now, which we hold by Abai. You only get six, but for Hashem, six is six. Still pretty good. What are they? Ya'al Kagam. Yeah, we will put them on the board, one up. Ya'al Kagam. Yud Ayin Lamed Kuf Ya'al Kagam. So what's Ya'al Kagam stand for? So Yud, the first one, is Ye'ush. So Rashi tells us what they are. Rashi lists them all. If you look at the Rashi, Ya'al Kagam. Yeush shalom da'at ba'alo metziut. What does that mean? So this is a case which is brought in Bava Batra. It's a case of Shabbat Aveda. What's the law of Shabbat Aveda? The law of Shabbat Aveda is that if you find a lost object, so you have to return it, or you have to make an effort to return it. And after a while, if no one claims it, then it's yours. The basis of that law is, though, at what point does it become mine? At what point in the process does it become mine? And Baba Metzia talks about that. So the answer given over there, Baba Metzia, is the point it becomes yours is at the point that the owner despairs of getting it back. The point that the owner despairs of getting it back. And that depends on a number of things, but it depends principally on what the object is. So, for example, money that's lying on the floor, if someone has a 20 shekel note and it flies out of his pocket, he basically despairs of getting it back as soon as it leaves his pocket. There's no identifying marks that it's his, and it's readily exchangeable, and he's not going to get it back. So he has yayush instantly. So anyone that finds money stamp doesn't have a duty really of hashavah. I'm not making a posek here, right? But just generally speaking from the halacha, right? Generally speaking, doesn't have a duty of hashavah. So don't rely on this, right? It's good to, you see here, someone lost some money and they put up a note or whatever. It's praiseworthy. But strictly speaking, if the person's got yayush, you don't need to. Because he's now abandoned it, so to speak. It's now ki'ilu got a law of hefka. He doesn't expect to get it back. So you can take it. It has no owner now. Because he's abandoned it. He's given up his expectation of getting it back. But if it's something valuable, and it's got your name on it, and it's not good for anyone else, no one else can use it. Right? So, like, let's say you lost a house key. It's only good for your house. And on the house key, you've got a name tab with your name and address and phone number. Right? So you don't despair for a long time. You expect someone's going to find it. Someone's going to call it back. So the yi'ush period... No, you disagree?
Second tab.
Okay.
Most people who lose a key change their...
Right. Now, yeah, but they don't. Okay, now in our day, so they. Not with the address on. Let's say you were walking in town, you just got your name and the phone number. So you don't think that anyone's going to find this key and locate you where your house is, top, whatever it is. But there's a period of time that's much longer. So I need to put, if I find it, I need to put up notices. And after how long? Maybe 3 months. So for sure, after 3 months, the person's despaired of ever getting it back, and if I like this key, I can take it and add it to my key collection, and it's mine, right? Or whatever it is. But after that period of yeush. So that's the standard law, of, roughly speaking, general of Shabbat Aveda, how long you need to wait, and when it becomes yours, and what you need to do. So here we're talking about a specific case, which is not a general case. Here's a case where some yeush shalom ida'at ba'ala. What's that? What is the case where the person doesn't realize he's lost it? Someone loses something but doesn't know he's lost it.
Still out of the pocket.
So what happens to that period of yayush? When does that yayush start ticking? Does it start ticking from the time he loses it? So the 3 months, if it was a 3 months. Let's say you needed to wait 3 months for this typical article. 3 months would be the period of time someone would give up. Or 2 weeks, whatever the specific, right? But the guy doesn't realize he's lost it yet. So is the yeush based on him? Or is it based on when you found it? Tom, anyway. Huh? You're right.
If you have to make the decision, not the bar.
So no, I think maybe here, I look up this case specifically, but it might be a case where where the one who found it knows that the owner, no, if he knows the owner, he has to give it back. Don't know. We have to look up Bava Matthiah 21b. Tov. I'll look at that. I'll read you the art scroll footnote. The dispute is whether an object found before the owner realized it was lost, and which we assume he would abandon hope of retrieving, even if he were aware it was missing, may be kept by the finder. Oh, so maybe he's saying like this. Money. If you would give up instantaneously on money, so can you say it's mine, even though he doesn't know he's lost it, so he hasn't got yosh. Fell out of his pocket while he wasn't looking. Right, he turned around, some money fell down. Do I have a duty, halachically, morally for sure I should pick it up and give it back to him, right? But he doesn't know yet, or maybe he's just run off and caught the train, whatever, I don't know. He doesn't realize he's lost it. When I pick it up, is it now mine? But he hasn't. Why did I say it was mine? So originally I said it was mine is because when a person realizes he's lost it, he's abandoned hope and it's now hefka. But he doesn't yet know that, so he hasn't yet abandoned hope. The moment he realizes is when it becomes hefka. But until then, maybe it hasn't become hefka. Maybe it's still his because he's still, his, so to speak, his mind is still on it. It's still connected to it. He hasn't yet abandoned that money because he doesn't know he's lost it. So maybe I can't take it legally. Why?
Because
it's
not a lost item
officially. It's his item, it's not lost.
He doesn't know it's lost.
Yeah, but you know it's lost. You saw it fall out of his pocket. You know he hasn't.
If you saw it fall out of his pocket.
If it's a lost item, it's different. If it, but if it's not lost, it belongs to him. It's his. I can't take something belonging to someone else.
If you took it,
I've only allowed.
It is mine.
Yeah, but so what's the reason? The only reason I can take an object is because I'm going to give it back to him. I know it's his, Shabbos Aveda. I'm holding on to it for him until he collects it. Or he's now abandoned it and it's now Hefka and it's, I can take it because it's free. They're the only two reasons I can actually pick it up. I'm going to give, so, but what's the status of it now in this limbo period before he realizes it's lost? So that's the question, that's what they argue on, and that's a Rav and Abai dispute, and in that dispute we go by Abai. That's Yud and Ya'el. Yush. Case of Yush. Right? We follow Abai. I don't know which way Abai was saying, but we follow Abai. Interesting case. Top. Lots of Gemaras for us to yet to learn. Top. Next. Eid Zomem. This one. Eid Zomem is what we just learned. In the case of Eid Zomem, Abai and Rava, we go by Abai. The case, and what does Abai hold? Abai hold Lamafreya, you're disqualified from the time you gave your false testimony. Follow Abai. Next, Lamed. What's Lamed? Lechi, Ha'omed Meilav. What's a Lechi? Huh? Yeah, but specifically, that generally speaking, it's the entrance, but specifically at the entrance, it's part of the entrance.
A lechi is usually a
pole that's at the beginning of the entrance, which gives the entrance status as being an entrance, being a gate.
To include it in an Arab, right?
In the case of a mavoi, an alleyway. Alleyway is between in the old days, there used to be alleyways between all the houses. And the big question was on Shabbos, because they didn't have Arabs. Right, some of them did, but most of them did not in the foreign cities. Right, they didn't put an Arab. Can you carry between the houses? So it depends on the status of the alleyway. So the alleyway needed to be marked in such a way, identified as being part of the Arab, being right. Could just be an alleyway. Could just be an alleyway stand. You had to put a lechi. A lechi is a pole that's at least. Dalet Amos High, I think. Two Amos High? Two Amos High. I can't remember. Anyway, there's a pole of certain length that you put at the gate. So here, so there's two ways. You have this is a lechi. A lechi is a beam of wood that stands upright here. You see them now here in Meshulim, they don't like relying on the overall big arrow, they've made their own little arrows as well. So then at least they know they're kosher or whatever. So, whatever reasons that people decide to make their own. But you sometimes see the beginning of alleyways like these little paint. Metal pole. That's also good. wood or a metal pole. That's called a lefty. And sometimes you can also do them a beam over the top. That also works as well. Mostly they did a lefty, which is easier to put up. I think you wouldn't worry about falling down on someone's head or getting in the way or whatever. So, and it identifies the fact that this is now part of the Arab. Anyway, so what happens with, so what happens in this case, what's the case? Alechi Almed Me'elav, where the Alechi that was standing there by itself, you didn't put it up there, but there was an extra piece of wood standing by the side of the, right, someone had left it from somewhere else, I know, but it wasn't, we didn't, can that count as a lechi? Because a lechi really doesn't do anything, except it's a hekera, it's a visual recognition, right? So the question, so you're not actually, you're not adding, because there's already a wall here, right? You didn't add anything to it, the wall was there, you put a post there to remind you. So the question is, if the post was already there, does it? Can you still use it as a lefty? You need to put your own one, or take it away and put it back, or I don't know. You need to do something to it. So in that dispute, we follow Abai. Again, I know, didn't look to see which way he goes, that you do or you don't, but we follow Abai. So, next, Kigam, Kuf. Kiddushin, Shalonim, Siru, Labia. So, Kiddushim, what's Kiddushim? Kiddushim is getting married. It's the marriage ceremony, basically, called Kiddushim. It's actually divided into two. We call it now engagement of marriage. Why? Only because it's from the Torah. The Torah taught us there's two parts of marriage. They're not exactly engagement. Engagement now is just an excuse to have a party. But in Torah law, there's two stages, Arusin and Kiddushim. Arusin, if you make engagement, it means that you're legally bound to that woman now, right? She can't, if she goes off and has a relationship with someone else in the meantime, you can take her out and stone her. Right? She's now, right, there's the marriage hasn't been consummated until the second half, which is Kiddushin. We now do them both together in Jewish law at the same time under the chuppah. You do Arushin followed by Kiddushin. In the old days, they used to do Arushin first, then there'd be a period of about a year while the bride got herself together and they got all the house together and they got all the plans and they worked right, and then a year later they do the second half Kiddushin. Anyway, Kiddushin is the bit we're talking about over here. Question is, what makes a valid Kiddushin? Right, to be valid, there's different ways of making Kiddushin. Money, shtar, or bia. You acquire a wife. Top, you acquire a wife. Buy, it's a kinyan, it's a transaction. What makes that transaction valid? Marriage is a transaction in Jewish law. It has to be a valid transaction. So it has to have all the laws of a valid transaction, just like selling you something, whatever. There's rules. There has to, and so too in marriage. Now, the question in dispute here is transaction, kinyan, whether the kiddushin that you did, you gave a ring, you gave money, whatever, you signed a ketubah, whether that's valid if you can't actually consummate the marriage by having relations with that woman. Why not? So the example given is, this is in the old days where you could used to marry two women. You could marry two women, even on the same day, in the same marriage ceremony. Perfectly. It happened. Right? There's nothing wrong with that. So now we don't do it because of rabbinic decrees. We don't do that anymore because we're not at levels that can't deal with one wife. Never mind. So, but in the old days you could. So what would happen if a man got married under the chuppah with two women at the same time? Right? And it turns out, it doesn't matter, he knew or he didn't know, whatever, it turns out they're both sisters. It turns out they're sisters. So he can't be with either one of them. Why not? Because we don't know which one is the first wife. Meaning, you could, with your wife, one of them you could be with, but the other one you can't. Right? You would have to be with a sister. I mean, someone who's got a sister is not a problem. But you can't, be with the wife of your sister, the sister of your wife. So you can't be with this one because she's a sister of your wife, and you can't be with that one because she's a sister of your wife. Right? So you're not allowed to be with either. So the question over there in the Gemara is that Kiddushin valid? Does it hold? Is it a proper transaction? The ketubah that you signed, is that valid? You actually married now, or you're not married? It's like something that, is it a valid, or it's not, because it's just like an impossible scenario. Right? Meaning, look, if you tried to get married and signed a ketubah with a donkey, it wouldn't be a valid kiddushin. It's like, we just didn't do anything. Question is, if you did it in this situation with two sisters, is it a valid that you need to have a get and you need to pay them the ketubah off? Right? Was it a valid kinyan or not? So that's the argument between Abai and Rava. And over there we follow Abai.
Why can't you...
Whether the kedushin is valid. Doesn't mean you can be with either one of them. You've got to undo it. You can. They're both married to you. You're not allowed to be with either one of them. You're probably going to have to divorce at least one. Divorce one. No, you can't be with the other one either until while she's alive. So you're going to have to divorce both. Because even if you divorce one, you're not allowed to be with the sister, even your ex-wife.
But you couldn't divorce because...
Until she died. After she died, you're allowed to.
If it's invalid, there's no get.
That's what I'm saying. If it's invalid, you don't have to divorce.
Right.
But if it is valid, then you would. That's the question. That's the question. They're not deciding whether or not you're allowed to be with them. They both agree you can't be. The question is whether or not the kedushin was valid. Does that hold?
So if it's not,
then it's not. Then you just walk
no,
yeah, everybody. Yeah, everyone just goes their own way. And top, we wasted a few $1,000 on the party, but top, that's all we lost, right? And then everyone just gets on with their life. But if not, then it was a kedushin, and it has implications. If he was a Kohen, if whatever, you know, depends. He was married and now he's a divorcee, has implications. Or he's not a divorcee. If he was a Kohen, for example, and now he's a divorcee or whatever, or the woman was divorced and the woman wants to now marry a Kohen because she can't, because she's now a divorcee. But if it wasn't a valid kedushin, she's not a divorcee, so she can go and marry a Kohen. So it depends whether or not that marriage that held or not.
But there was an actual case this year where a woman wanted to marry a Kohen, and she was previously married.
Yeah.
But they said it was an invalid ketubah.
Right. So if you can nullify the marriage, then that's fine. So people look to do that, especially in the case of Mamzerim, for example. They try and, in the case of Mamzerim, what often happens is, especially people who are Chiloni and they don't know, or they become from later, Baal Teshuvah, and they were still married, and they never got a proper divorce, and then they went and had a relationship with, they had a civil divorce, or they separated, or whatever they did, and then he went and had a relationship with someone else, happens, and 10 years later, see you later, and he goes and has a relationship with someone else. They never got a proper valid get from a Beit Din, so they're still halachically married to the first one, and now she has a relationship with someone else, and has a kid, and kid's a mamzer. Halachically a mamzer, that's very problematic. So what did they do? So they come down and try and undo the first marriage, say the first marriage was really never valid. We try and look for a way to see if we can undo that first marriage. To try and save the kid from being top. Anyway, not our topic today.
So isn't there another one?
Why he can't divorce one of them?
Yes, and then what?
Shalom?
No, because you're not allowed to marry the sister of your wife while she's alive. If you're married now to a woman, and she has a sister, you like her sister very much, and you say, you know what, I'm going to divorce you and marry your sister. You're not allowed. You can't be married to a sister in the lifetime. When the woman's dead, then you can marry the sister. But not in a lifetime.
We have two more.
Yes. Tov, that was Kedushin. Next, Gam, Ger. Gilui Data Begita. Clarification regarding a get. That's an interesting one. Gilui Dea. What's Gilui Dea? So there's Gilui Da'at is like a whole idea by itself of you reveal the intention. The intention became clear. In different areas of law, especially in halal transaction law, these are all transactions. Give a get is a transaction, right? The intention to know, especially a get, the law of get, if you learn getting is a great effort to learn. It's not so long and it's very interesting. The law of giving a get, there's all sorts of stuff about you're allowed to do the shaliach to give the get, right? And you have to hand it to the person, but can you throw it to them if it lands near them? If the wind takes it away, it was all different halakhic queries about what happens. Was it a valid get? Was it validly given over? Anyway, so what happens here, we're talking about a case of where in order to give a get, you actually have to validly want to give a get. If for example, what happens, a very strange case, mash strange, don't lose your faith because of this case, right? Because it's hard to understand how it works. But I'm going to tell you anyway, because these are some of the difficulties that we have to grapple with. A man wishes to divorce his wife.
What?
A man wants to divorce his wife. He's not living in the same city that she is. So he writes a get, and he gives it to a messenger to take it to where she lives in her new city. On the way, the guy changes his mind and says, you know what? I don't want to divorce her. And the shliach doesn't know before the age of the cell phone. Right? Gives her the get. Is she now divorced? Answer, no. She's actually not divorced. It's an amazing ruling, right? Because it doesn't have to be that way, but it has to be that way. Right? So here we're dealing with the case of Gilui Dat, the intention of the man who is giving the get. He can't do it as a joke. Right? If a guy gives over there in Gittin, an example of a guy who writes the get and then taunts his wife, right, with it, by threatening to divorce her, but he doesn't really mean it. He's just
crazy.
Like, yeah, there were people like that, unfortunately. Right, he writes it, he weighs it, and every time she forgets to make him coffee exactly with 3 sugars or whatever it was. Right, so he waves the get under an oath, or gives it to her and says, "There's your get," but he doesn't mean it. So it's not divorced. So what happened, Tom?
It's not the only example that Gilui Dat that he has.
This is Gilui Dat. Yeah. Afterwards, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but it's not the only example of how precious is the Gilui Dat. Also, when somebody robbed the bank now, I don't know, the gun is right here. He robbed the bank. At the bank, he's a real Russia, and now we go and make kiddushim and say, "At mekudesh at least, that I'm tzadik gamur."
Tonight,
the kiddushim. Yeah. How come? Because maybe
he has had a thought of teshuva.
So what's going on in the mind? It's very important. Yeah.
So also for kiddushim, both to make a marriage and to end one, you have to any kinyan, you have to have intention. We looked at that in other ways. You have to have intention to actually make that transaction. If your mind is not, there's no kinyan gamor, we said, to give over the money in the case of dice playing. Here, you
also learned that you like the game has to be intentional
for that person. Yeah, fair. So the all beautiful rules. So anyway, so what happens here? So here we have Gilui Dat of, we don't know, but we have Gilui Dat that the man did not intend to give the get. What's the case? So the case that the Gemara brings is that the man sends a shaliach to give the get, but he gets there and he can't find the woman. So he let's say in our terms, wasn't in their terms, but in our terms, he calls up on the phone, right? They don't, but makes it easier for us to picture it. He calls up on the phone and says, "Can't find her. She's not here." The guy says, the language of the Gemara, and the Gemara focused on the exact language he uses, the exact language that the husband says is what reveals his intention. So it's one. The husband says, "Baruch Hashem." The exact wording of what he says, I can't remember exactly, but it's roughly Baruch Hashem. It says in a different Aramaic language, but it's Baruch Hashem. Does that mean he was happy that he didn't find her, now he's revealed his intention, he doesn't really want it, and then the phone goes dead, and then the shaliach sees her coming along and says, "Oh, there you are, here's the get." but now he's already revealed Gilui Da'at that he never wanted to give it to her. Is that Baruch Hashem? They discussed that. Is that Baruch Hashem? A Gilui Da'at that he's now changed his mind, he doesn't want to give it to her. So in that argument of Gilui Da'at, that's for the Abai and Rava case of, we go by Abai. So what's the argument between it is whether certain statements or actions of a husband can be interpreted as a nullification of the get. So one of them holds that we do go by statements or actions. The other says no, unless he said I hereby nullify the get, it's not nullified. The fact that you showed that you were happy, she never got it, I don't care. I don't go by Gilui Da'at. The other one says no. So, and the last one. Muma ochel nevelot lahachis is what we're going to learn now. Top, so let's learn that in Hashem's help. Muma, that's the sixth one. The case where we follow Abai, the dispute between Abai and Rava, and we follow Abai. All the rest, we go by Rava. Top. Mumar, what's a Mumar? Huh? Yeah, we use the word Muma in a few different contexts, all within that concept. It's someone who's breaking Torah in some way, right? Deliberately breaking Torah, deliberately rebelling, going against, showing that he's not interested. I've seen before in the halacha that a Mumar is someone who breaks, as an example of a Mumar, someone who breaks Shabbos in public. Right? He's showing that he's not interested, publicly showing that he's not interested. The questions that include people who don't know what they're doing. Right? When that was written, what a Mumar was, we're talking like, right? In the old days, when everybody either, there were only two options. You kept the halachas, or you didn't. It wasn't like this third option where I don't really know and I quite like to be a Jew and a top. Usually if you publicly broke Shabbos, it's because you were denouncing your religion. There's no other reason for public breaking Shabbos when you're in the shtetl. Right? Like deliberately, not like just as a one-off. So here,
that's too different.
And if you are Mumar, if you have the status of a Mumar, it has a halachic implications. A Mumma can't be part of a minion, can't be different things that Mumma can't be. Right? If you're a halakhic, but there's a question now, what makes you a halakhic Mumma? Right? So most people, I understand, wouldn't take publicly desecrating Shabbos as being a Mumma, because then that disqualifies, unfortunately.
No, but if you became a Catholic priest or a Buddhist monk,
then that probably would. Right. So then you're definitely, You're denouncing the religion, but you're not denouncing the religion by driving on Shabbos, right? Because most of the people who drive on Shabbos in this country still fast on Yom Kippur and still have mezuzahs on their doors and still show that they actually want to be Jews, right? So it doesn't go like before when you did that in public. You were like, you don't keep in anything. You're showing that you're right. They eat kosher meat, most of them, right? But they're not.
There is a very important point about Mumar.
Yeah.
There is Mumar le Tiavon and Mumar le Achis.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at now. So that we're now looking at the. We're going to look at that. That's the question the Gemara has now.
Probably it's also Nafkamina, what the Rabbi said. That if it's le Tiavon, it also will be disqualified from this communication from the Knesset because.
So now we're gonna see the difference and whether or not you're disqualified if you're lachis or l'tevo. So what Rabbi Eliezer over here is telling us that here the Gemara is bringing a case of muma ochel nevelot, person who eats nevelot, not like just ish ochel nevelot, a muma ochel nevelot. Right, he's doing it dafka. Right, he's doing it publicly, and he's doing it. I'm eating. What's an avela? Avela just means a meat without a hekshah. meat that hasn't been halakhically hectored, slaughtered. Shechita, right? Doesn't mean he's going around in the field looking for a bit of dead animal that fell out a tree, right? He's eating, instead of going to the kosher butcher where they're charging £200 a slice, there he goes to the other one down the road, it's much cheaper, right? So the question is...
So this is not someone who's walking into McDonald's and ordering a ham.
So now we don't know. So we're going to see now, what are the options for this guy? What is he actually doing here? We're talking about a mumma who's eating the veilot, right, and kosher food. Le teavon. For his teavon. Now, Rabbi Eleazar pointed out there's two types of mumma. You could be a mumma le teavon. Teavon means for your appetite, for your... Right? Because you're hungry. Because you desire the food. For the sake, it tastes nice. Someone told you that bacon is really tasty and you can't get such a taste when you make a smoked beef sandwich. Truth is, that's not true. The Gemara tells us that every unkosher taste is available in a kosher way. Right? There's all kosher, all that you can find it, might find it something else. Chicken, usually... covers most crocodile, yes, like chicken.
Actually, we have
steak, yeah, it's like chicken.
We have recipe in here.
Oh, there we go. Let's plug the book. Anyone who wants to eat a what? A toad? What are you selling? What are you cooking here? What are we cooking here?
It's chicken that tastes like ham.
Chicken that tastes like ham. You can get bacon bits. Certified Badat's bacon bits. That's not true. I was about to say I have no idea if they taste like the real thing, but only because I haven't tasted the Badat's bacon bits.
And then you have the other white meat.
Here you can make lots of things that uncooked ogre fondant, for example. And other holy endeavors. Right, so, anyway, this guy is eating the veil of meat because he likes the taste. Or he's doing it for tev. As opposed to lahachis. What's lahachis? What's from the word? From the root? Angry. Kaas. Anger. He's not doing it because he's angry, I'm going to show you. I'm upset. I'm just going to eat it. I don't care what you say. Right? Children do this. Not my children, obviously, they're perfect. But apparently other children, they get upset with their parents and they do think dafka. I'm not benching, like Alavai. Alavai, that should be the right. I'm not benching today. Right? Why? Because I'm upset, right? It's not because she doesn't want to bench, she doesn't care. Oh, I didn't get that, because you're annoying me. I'm making a point. Right?
It's especially bad with teenagers.
Yes, right. So that's lahachis. It's not because they're denouncing the religion and they're rebelling against God. No, they're rebelling against you, right? They're angry, right? But it's not. But if I'm doing it the teavon, then I'm throwing out halacha for a nice juicy piece of steak. Right, and that is, that's not a one-off, that's not an excusable, for that, hakol pasul, everybody agrees that you're pasul.
When you make it tavon?
Yeah.
And when you do it lachis, it's better?
No. When you do it lachis, lachis, abay ma pasul, rabba ma kasher.
It's much worse.
No. Why?
Lachis is revolution. Tavon, the guy was hungry. He not have any problem with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. He doesn't want to make a war against the Kodesh Baruch
Hu. Yeah, but here what we're talking about. Here we're talking about whether he's trustworthy to be a witness or a judge. In the case of Tavon, it shows that he's willing to bend the rules, break the rules, for the sake of his Tavon. So someone offers him money to lie, so well, that's also good for me. But when a person is just angry, then it doesn't show that he's necessarily going to take money to break the rules. He can still be believed as a truthful witness. He was upset for a reason, and he was doing it to get back, not because he cared. Achis means that he didn't care about the actual thing. He could have picked anything. Just happened to be, fine, give me that meat. I don't care about the meat. I wanted to make a statement to show that I was angry. So in that case, Rava says he's still eligible to... We're going to see, that's still the basis. We're going to see that.
Still what? Eligible?
Eligible to... He can still be a witness. Why? We're going to see now, the Gemara is going to say, what are the reasons for Abai and Rava? Why does Abai, in the second case of Lachis, why does Abai disqualify and Rava says it's okay? You're not disqualified.
It may be fine for a witness, but what about a judge? Do you really want a judge who can't control his temper?
Yeah, but temper has never been a criteria. It's nice,
because
you're right.
He can't control his das.
Nachon, but you're right, but it's not halachic reason to disqualify. It's not a good midah, but it's not a halachic reason to disqualify them from being in that position. Otherwise we'd have a lot of trouble putting any position. Okay, so let's see what the Gemara says are the reasons. Abai Amar Pasul. Abai said that they're disqualified, they're Pasul. Why? To have a Rasha, because he's a Rasha. Wrote to a law, et nevelas, et treif. Right? He's a Rasha. V'rachman Amar, the Torah told, Hashem said, Al Tashit Rasha Ed, don't place your hand with an evildoer to be a witness. Right? Abai goes by the opinion that a Rasha, if you're a Rasha, if you break any Torah law, you can't be a witness. Because he takes the pasuk of a Rasha can't be a witness. And a Rasha is someone who deliberately breaks Torah law. Not accidentally, but deliberately breaks Torah law. He's a Rasha and he can't be a witness. Rava says no. Rava Amar Kasher, why? Rasha to Hamas Be'inan. We require in the case of disqualification a Rasha de Hamas. Hamas, we said, was robbery. We need the Rasha which has the taste of robbery, which has the aspect of robbery. It's not any type of Rasha. It's only those Rashaim who are related to monetary gain, like we said in the past. That's Rav Yehuda. And here we have now, finally, the Gemara is bringing that explicit argument that we saw running through the whole thing. Only those, according to Rava, only those things where there's a financial problem means that you can't be a witness. Other problems, like you ate trace meat, fine, it's not good, you broke the law, but it's got nothing to do with being a witness. Witnesses, being disqualified of a witness is only, says Rava, not Abai, but Rava says, only a question of your financial integrity. If that's suspect, we get rid of you. But if you ate trace meat, right, you're Russia, you break Torah law, but not financially suspect, you're not likely to be bribed. Therefore, you're allowed to be a witness. You're allowed to be a witness in a murder case. You can't disqualify this witness in a murder case because you saw him eating some trace meat. Unless you're Abai, and you can't, okay?
Bribing with trace meat.
But bribing with trace meat.
More importantly, given the extreme difference between trace and kosher meat, yeah, especially with a good heksher, isn't that a financial gain?
So, Tom, there's an opinion that you could go that way. All right, let's stop there. Hashem, we'll finish that.